Welcome to the Walk a Mile in My Shoes podcast. In this solo episode, I talk openly and frankly about my mental ill health, the childhood experiences that led to that mental ill health, and some of my continued experiences of prejudice and discrimination from folk who really ought to know better. It also includes details of a remarkably unsuccessful job application with the NHS. If this isn't your cup of tea, then feel free to have a listen to the other episodes where I interview some truly fabulous folk. Also, bear in mind, I've got some really interesting guests lined up for your listening pleasure in the future. In making this podcast, I'm a bit concerned I might be burning some bridges. That said, there's a strong chance those bridges only ever existed in my mind, an illusion, a figment of my ever-hopeful imagination. Welcome back, dear listener, to this flight of fancy where I talk about how my heart was broken not once, but twice over the space of just a few months. No, silly, this isn't about me and the lovely Ella. We're still as happy things. I won't gush. I appreciate it can be nauseating for some, but she really is the bee's whiskers. No, this is a tale about how I, a rapidly approaching 57-year-old white man with a mental malady that just refuses to fuck off, along with some brand new physical ailments, fits into the world. Specifically, I'm talking about the world of employment. This is by no means a perfect podcast, since it's written as much by my heart as my mind, but it was vital for me that I put down some words to the feelings I experienced when I realised the world was perhaps not how I thought it was, or how I hoped it would be. Not so long ago, I spoke to a friend of ours who's responsible for the running of a factory that produces doofers. What it produces really doesn't matter. Their process requires attentive workers to be part of an intensive production line, a place for everyone and everyone in their place. Somewhat whimsically, I asked them if they'd ever employ me or someone like me. Before you could say reasonable adjustments, they replied, "Of course not." Essentially saying that the factory required its worker ants to be both present in the moment and present at work, neither of which I could guarantee with my errant mind. Feeling an emotional slap in my face at this, I mean, if I couldn't fit into that world, what hope was there for me in the world? I bravely ran away from the conversation. Even more recently, I was thrilled to see jobs being advertised across the country that put my flavour of madness at the front and centre of the process. Not only were they saying they'd employ somebody like me, but that my experience of mental ill health was an essential requirement, a prerequisite qualification for the job. And there was one such opportunity in my area in sunny Warwickshire. In true NHS style, the job was advertised with a remarkably convoluted and potentially meaningless title. They were looking for an Advanced Lived Experience Cuff Development Lead Band 7. Interestingly, the job demands that the applicant can express and articulate ideas in a way that's appropriate and easily understood, avoiding jargon. Strokes chin thoughtfully. Translated, this is a job to provide training under the knowledge and understanding framework. You know, that gets more 1984 each time I say it, to professionals, both clinical and non-clinical, to ensure they work more effectively with people with the label of personality disorder. Advanced lived experience meant they were looking for a crazy person. So this ticked all my boxes. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Towards the end of my counselling with the fine folk at Safeline in Warwick, not provided by the NHS, not some therapeutic product or panacea like CBT or DBT or mentalisation-based therapy or mindfulness, no, this was imaginative, challenging, compassionate counselling where the relationship was all. I started to think about how services for folk with mental maladies, and especially for folk lugging around the label of borderline personality disorder, could be much better. Money would help. Of course it would. We live in a country that spends less than half per head of population per year on health services than the United States. Yes, I know they spaff a significant amount of that money on obscure and opaque insurance policies, often ensuring those who are in most need don't get it. Capitalism, as you know, is very expensive. But it's not just about money, is it? It's about a whole bunch of other stuff, often driven by ignorance, arrogance, and prejudice. We talked about how the system would be significantly better if people with experience of mental ill health and the myriad systems involved in fucking their lives up were placed in positions of power where they helped plan and deliver services that made real positive changes to people's lives. Well, lo and behold, you could have knocked me down with a feather when a bit of Googling revealed the emergence of the very jobs I'd been dreaming of. Okay, to reiterate, in true NHS fashion, it had been given the rather wordy title of Advanced Lived Experience Cuff Development Lead Band 7, but this was it. Real change was afoot. This was a fabulous opportunity for me to combine my joint experiences of long-term crazy person and 20 years of working in social care, including 17 of those as a social worker. Not to mention, well, why are you mentioning it? What are you talking about? You can't argue with me. You're me. So, not to mention my years of making a racket about the whole mental gig through walking a mile in other people's shoes, walking around the edge of the UK, joining up with the fabulous folk at See Me Scotland to pull punters and professionals together to literally walk a mile in each other's shoes, to share their experiences and to challenge the false dichotomy that had emerged that you are either a punter or professional, when in actual fact, many of us were both. My lived experience, we really must do something about that phrase. It's both meaningless and a bit weird. We can do better. My lived experience as a crazy person is even more extensive. The system is truly shocking. About 3 years ago, I was referred to the community mental health services by a GP who felt my life was at risk. I was experiencing invasive and vivid suicidal ideation and urges to self-harm. I was dissociating two-thirds of the time, and agoraphobia meant I hadn't gone out on my own for 2 years. I was also necking 800 milligrams of quetiapine a day, an antipsychotic, roughly enough to stop a charging rhino. Venturing out, even with the lovely Ella by my side, was as rare as hen's teeth. I had 3 assessments in that time, an initial phone call where somebody or other made a decision about something or other. They didn't tell me what to expect, they didn't tell me what they were doing, or what their thoughts were, or how long I'd have to wait. 6 months later, I received a letter telling me I had to attend an assessment 20 miles away, and that if I didn't turn up, they'd remove me from the waiting list. It was okay. Ella was going to drive me there. Everything would be fine. Only she went and got double pneumonia and was rushed into hospital. She's fine now, but it was all a bit scary at the time. As a result, I had to drive myself to the appointment while I was dissociating. Not something I'd recommend. The standout moment for me was when the mental health social worker told me she couldn't condone what I'd done. What did she expect me to do? I was desperate. I'd already waited 6 months, and they were threatening to take me off the waiting list if I didn't turn up. 2 months later, I was assessed, reviewed by a psychologist who clearly had no idea I'd been assessed by the other team. During her time on the phone, she strongly implied that mindfulness was the cure for everything. I told her I'd tried it in various guises, but at moments of distress, being in the moment was something that really didn't help. Also, with dissociation, it was hard to know where I was at any given moment. She essentially said I'd been doing it wrong. Even when I told her that I did it with psychologists in the past, she strongly implied they must have been doing it wrong too. We talked about dissociation. I'm not sure why I found it so irritating, but she kept calling it disassociation as we talked about stress. I explained because of dissociation, I didn't experience stress like other folk. My overzealous mind would jump in and I'd feel nothing. She insisted I was experiencing stress. The dissociation was a stress response. We weren't arguing or even disagreeing. She just wanted to wanted to show she was right and who was in charge. I said, I thought you'd said I was the expert, as she went on to tell me how she was paying lip service to the idea, since she was a qualified clinical psychologist. We talked about my medication and how my GP had a flexible approach that allowed me to take as much as 800 milligrams of quetiapine a day. Occasionally, on better days, it could be as low as 600. And that felt okay. She referred me to psychiatry, clearly panicked that me and my GP had gone a bit off-piste. It didn't matter what I thought, she just went ahead and did it. She had no idea how long it would be before I saw someone for the actual reason I'd been referred. You know, talking therapies. And that was that. Every 3 months for the next 2 years, I'd get a letter telling me I had to had a phone appointment with a psychiatrist. If I missed those calls for any reason, it could mean being removed from the waiting list that had no discernible end, and that would mean having to start the whole process all over again. The psychiatrists were variable, a different one phoning me each time. When I say variable, the worst was the one who said right at the beginning of the call they didn't have very long since they had to call someone else. They had no idea about me, my level of mental distress, or even why they were phoning. The best was the psychiatrist who took a full case history. I have no idea why they did that. The details would have been in my notes. Hopefully. The cynic in me believes he did this because he saw me as a valuable learning experience, nothing more. His interest made absolutely no difference to my circumstances. Just like all the others who'd phoned, he had no idea where I was on the waiting list. That said, he was better than some who thought I was well into therapy and the NHS waiting list was but a passing memory. They finally got in touch with me 2 years after the original referral to tell me the good news that I was approaching the top of the list for, as yet, unspecified talking therapy. The person who contacted me sounded utterly exhausted, wrecked by years of chronic underfunding, doing all they could to put out all the fires around them while their managers continued to make efficiency savings. It was with a heavy heart that over an hour's discussion, we finally concluded that, after all this time, I wouldn't be taking them up on therapy because I was reaching the end of a year and a bit of counselling with Safeline, which had got me to a point where my dissociation had significantly decreased, and after months of tapering, I was now off the drugs. My mental health, I told them, hadn't been this good in years. And so, reluctantly, she removed me from the waiting list. This was, still is, a period of hope for me. After a lifetime of craziness brought on by childhood trauma of watching my beautiful mum being torn from us by cervical cancer when I'd just turned 12, how my lovely dad finally collapsed in on himself after watching her transform from a loving wife into a writhing, groaning animal incapable of speech, succumbing to the need to self-medicate his pain away with Bell's whiskey, how our fabulous home turned into a filthy shithole, strewn with cat feces and the bodies of the myriad small animals they brought into the house to slaughter, the walls, ceilings and net curtains yellowed by the nicotine of Dad's roll-ups, a home that wouldn't have looked out of place in many of the zoo TV documentaries on Channel 4 and 5, how I became one of the smelly kids at school, a state born out of abject poverty, with old newspaper as toilet paper, a 50p meter on the side of the TV, tatty hand-me-downs and shoes that not only couldn't keep the weather out but struggled to keep my feet in, teeth coated with tartar and plaque because of the lack of toothbrushes and toothpaste, where I learned I was on the absolute periphery of my school society, where I fainted in woodwork because of chronic hunger. How, in this state of vulnerability, I was groomed and sexually abused by a woman very close to me. Thanks to these experiences, I developed a vast array of coping strategies, from writing stories, to fighting, to self-harming, using edgy humour, suicidal ideation, and dissociation. The world could only see the child before it, the dirty, often ridiculous, often hilarious, often intelligent, ball of craziness. It wasn't interested in what had delivered me to this point. All it could see was something to be mocked, feared, and if I was lucky, pitied. I won't name the woman who counselled me over the past year and a bit. She wouldn't want me to. But thanks to her, I got to a point where I could see a future. A future where I could apply for a job as a lived experience doodad. I'll cut to the chase. This doesn't end well. In late September last year, I downloaded the pack to see just what the Coventry and Warwickshire NHS partnership wanted for just over £40,000 a year. They want someone with a lived experience of tick, someone with a postgraduate degree, tick, ideally with some manner of teaching qualification, tick, with management experience, supervision, mentoring, supporting staff in stressful circumstances, tick, tick and tick, of developing services, tick, working knowledge of organisational dynamics theory. Sorry, what on earth is that? The word recovery went through the whole application like Blackpool through a stick of rock. I was beginning to get a funny feeling about this. The feeling that comes with a belief that they want a cured, reformed, crazy person who would look like, walk like, and talk like them. Who, just like a circus act with a chimp dressed in human clothes, they could pretend the applicant, me in this instance, was just like them. My lived experience was only acceptable if I'd stopped experiencing it. Thanks very much. I tried to contact the contact person who could tell me more about this groundbreaking, world-changing job. They were on annual leave, leaving no alternative contact. I spoke with some friends who'd been involved in CUF. They talked about how the training would encourage a more trauma-informed approach to working with punters branded with a personality disorder label, how they'd help staff explore the myths, by which I think they mean institutional prejudices, surrounding the labels. Two things leapt out at me in these conversations. The training wasn't mandatory, which meant the same old, well-intentioned and already converted people would continue to turn up, while those responsible for much of the prejudice and discrimination endured by people with a label of personality disorder continue to fester in their dark corners, mumbling something about political correctness gone mad, with no fear of sanctions. Secondly, the training is apolitical. Although it can't be, it is. There's no space to tear the whole construct apart for being both scientifically unreliable and invalid, nor does there appear to be a place to talk about the latest incarnation of the International Classification of Diseases, the ICD-11, that will wreak carnage on the very people it claims to support. Under a duplicitous cloak of sound clinical practice, this new system is little more than gatekeeping of services, which means thousands of vulnerable people will receive little more than a diagnosis. I have put a link to where I talk more comprehensively about this in the blurb. I put my application in, mainly because services to people lugging around a label of personality disorder is really important to me. One of the things that left me particularly cold, like I was in cahoots with the devil, just before I pressed send on my application, was the bit of the job description under patient contact. They said if I got the job, my experience of patient contact would be incidental. How could I possibly develop bespoke training on top of CUF whilst developing pathways to personality disorder services if my patient contact was incidental? The more I went over this, the more I felt that the application form and job description had been nowhere near anyone with a lived experience. I finally got to speak with the contact person a week after my application had gone in. To be honest, I was still 75% convinced that I didn't want to touch this post with a barge pole. The more I spoke with her, the further I wanted to run. But they'd been given £11 million to develop the service. I really didn't want them to fuck it up. It very soon transpired she knew about as much about the job as I did. Any answers she gave me were either read directly from the job description or, this is something we'd expect you to develop in the post, or a flat out, I don't know. A few things stood out in the conversation. When I mentioned reasonable adjustments, she responded like I just asked her to accompany me on a trip to the moon, on a unicycle. She mumbled something about occupational health. I had experience of this when I was turfed out of social work. You're either mad or not mad. And more importantly, that madness is located in you. We'll be making no adjustments, thanks very much. It felt a lot like talking to a wheelchair user, telling them to reapply once they could walk up two flights of stairs. The lived experience Band 7 job requires the newly appointed person to travel extensively around the Coventry and Warwickshire environs, doing good work. I explained being a crazy person doesn't come with a car, or a sparkling credit rating for that matter. A reasonable adjustment in this instance might be a car, or access to one. She explained that contrary to the job description, most of the work would be done from the comfort of my own home and that any extensive travelling about the place could be done by public transport. It had obviously been a while since she'd been in this under-resourced world where public transport is laughingly bad. Not as hilariously awful as in some areas of the Highlands of Scotland where that are served by a bus twice a week, but still, you know, shit. And there's the horrible irony. So great is their need to employ someone who's just like them, whilst ignoring the need for reasonable adjustments, the NHS is failing to meet the most basic requirements of the 2010 Equality Act. I'll say that again. A job that claims to put people with a lived experience of mental ill health front and centre in their development of staff training and pathways to services actively discriminates against the people they say they want to employ. I'll put a link in the blurb for you to shake your head in bewilderment at. This is lifted directly from the Equality and Human Rights Commission's website. Indirect discrimination happens when an organisation has a particular policy or way of working that has a worse impact on disabled people compared to people who are not disabled. Indirect disability discrimination is unlawful unless the organisation or employer is able to show that there is a good reason for the policy and it is proportionate. This is known as objective justification. For example, a job advert states that all applicants must have a driving licence. This puts some disabled people at a disadvantage because they may not have a licence because, for example, they might have epilepsy. If the advert is for a bus driver job, the requirement will be justified. If it is for a teacher to work across two schools, it will be more difficult to justify. In this case, the NHS falls flat on its face right from the start. By demanding a plethora of unnecessary qualifications, they're discriminating against people who've already felt the icy hand of prejudice when accessing, or not, an education system that's either unable, but more often unwilling, to make reasonable adjustments to ensure people with mental ill health enjoy the same unfettered access to all its services without having to jump through obscure hoops. Yes, what I'm saying is that a person with a postgraduate degree in underwater pig wrestling would be more than able to step up to the requirements of the Advanced Lived Experience Cuff Development Lead, Band 7. I appreciate this may be contentious, but I believe my degree in psychology wouldn't have improved my in-post performance. Similarly, my master's in social work, two years of academic mediocrity, both mine and the university's, an unnecessary yet necessary hoop to jump through to give me the heady title of social worker would add nothing to the job. The same goes for my practice teaching qualification that allowed me to supervise and mentor social workers on their social work placements. They're all meaningless. Blunt instruments that the NHS in this instance is using to gatekeep this most precious of roles. I'm fortunate. Even through my years of craziness, I was able to do just enough to acquire these golden tickets for a better future. I'm not better than other applicants. I'm just fortunate that I was well enough or had the ability or the foresight to hide my craziness, to scrape through. There are other ways to demonstrate an ability to think critically than waving a piece of paper around. The people looking for the right person for the job would have to make reasonable adjustments, though. The more the post demands that the applicant fits in with the organisation whilst failing to even consider reasonable adjustments, the more they will lose what makes that lived experience unique. I cannot stress enough the most valuable commodity of someone with a lived experience when you're looking for someone with a lived experience is their lived experience. This isn't rocket science. Similarly, when they ask for references from employment with a minimum of 3 years' service, it completely ignores the fact that having a mental malady in a job that is ill-equipped to support people with that lived experience, with the very lived experience you're looking for in your post, often leads to a fragmented employment career. If you demand that one of the referees must be your last employer, which in my case ended up in the mother and father of all train wrecks, where I was turfed out of my job, where my manager was so uninsightful he told me he was jealous of me because I was being disabled out because of my newfound loony label. I'm certain I'm not the only one this has happened to, where an organisation is institutionally prejudiced against people with my label, then you're not going to get the most glowing appraisal, are you? This job must be seen as a fabulous opportunity, a possible agent for change in a horribly flawed system. If you just carry on as before without celebrating the potential and diversity in your potential candidates, then not only will your service fail to evolve, it'll continue to stagnate in the prejudicial quagmire you find yourself in today. If you stick a judgmental question bang in the centre of the application that demands the applicant to account for any periods of unemployment, then your organisation is placing yet another huge stumbling block in the way of getting the right person for the job. When I saw it, I was tempted to say I was taking a 15-year sabbatical while I gained the lived experience required for the job. In asking this question, you are failing to meet both the letter and the spirit of the 2010 Act. You are discriminating against people who have experienced unemployment, often because of employers' and society's reaction to their personality disorder label. At the same time, ignoring how valuable that experience is. The fine people at the Human Rights Commission go on to talk about reasonable adjustments. Under the Equality Act, employers and organisations have a responsibility to make sure that disabled people can access jobs, education and services as easily as non-disabled people. This is known as the duty to make responsible adjustments. Duty to make reasonable adjustments. Disabled people can experience discrimination if the employer or organisation doesn't make a reasonable adjustment. This is known as failure to make reasonable adjustments. For example, an employee with a mobility impairment needs a parking space close to the office. However, her employer only gives parking spaces to senior managers and refuses to give her a designated parking space. What is reasonable depends on a number of factors, including the resources available to the organisation making that adjustment. If an organisation already has a number of parking spaces, it would be reasonable for it to designate one close to the entrance for the employee. I wouldn't begin to suggest that making reasonable adjustments for your advanced lived experience CUF development lead band 7 would be straightforward, but, and this is a huge but, this appointment must lead the way in exemplary practice. The implementation of reasonable adjustments must be both effective and nimble. Effective in that they make the job more accessible to the incumbent, and nimble for the times when they need adjustment and development. If the NHS manages this with the development lead, then this would pave the way for the best practice when employing their lived experience cuff grade 3 folk. Abraham Lincoln said, "If I had 8 hours to chop down a tree, I'd spend 6 sharpening my axe." I really don't see a lot of axe sharpening going on here. Possibly the most insidious thing in this whole sorry process for me is the way the word recovery is bandied around. As I mentioned earlier, it's ubiquitous throughout the job description and application form. It demands that I, as the applicant, must have a clear understanding of personal recovery and that of others I'd worked with. When I spoke with the contact clinical psychologist person, it soon became clear she had no idea what was meant by recovery either. I'm fairly sure if you gathered 20 people into a room, both professionals and punters, and asked them what they understood recovery to be, then you'd get 20 different answers, give or take. It reminds me a lot of the use of the word normalisation in the 1980s and 90s, a word that supposedly described how best to work with people with learning disabilities and or mental maladies. Everybody thought they knew what it meant, but so many people had so many different ideas and perspectives on what was normal, it rendered the word meaningless and, more importantly, useless. In the case of those hoping to bag themselves an advanced lived experience cuff development lead band 7, I strongly suspect that by recovery they meant cured. And if you're cured, with no discernible disabilities or maladies, then obviously they'd have no reasonable adjustments to make. But that takes us right back to square one. They don't want the messy inconvenience of employing someone with an ongoing mental malady, even though they would be exactly the right person for the job. If you want to employ someone with a lived experience, then the well-not-well dichotomy has to go. You must start to fashion reasonable adjustments that can accommodate symptoms like invasive thoughts of suicide and self-harm, of dissociation and psychosis. I have these symptoms and more. Even though I know the symptoms, it doesn't make them any less pernicious and crippling at the time. That said, outside of this cacophony of symptoms, I know I can be incredibly productive. I can write, be supportive, make podcasts, research, engage with folk, including punters, professionals, and the general public. I can lead campaigns. I can engage with social and mainstream media and people from all walks of life. But it must be acknowledged that these symptoms are incredibly unpredictable. They may be a response to a trigger or not. They can last between an hour or several days, so working out reasonable adjustments will be a real challenge. A challenge, I feel, that would be worth it in the long term, not just for the NHS, but for other organisations who, at the moment, really have no clue what a mental health ramp looks like. Just before I fired off my application, I spent a long time gazing at the tick box that asked the question, "If you have a disability, do you wish to be considered under the guaranteed interview scheme if you meet the minimum criteria as specified in the personal specification?" Like many before me, and I dare say after me, I struggled with the notion that I might get employed out of some weird notion of positive discrimination or some other nonsense. I gave myself a metaphorical slap. Surely this is what the post should be all about. On reflection, I really shouldn't have given it a second thought. I wasn't invited for an interview, even though, I'd argue, you would say that, wouldn't you? I met the minimum, wholly unreasonable, discriminatory, illegal criteria as specified in the job description. "Dear Christopher Young, thank you for your application for vacancy Advanced Lived Experience Development Lead Band 7 at Coventry and Warwickshire Partnership NHS Trust. Unfortunately, your application was not successful on this occasion. Regrettably, feedback will not be provided." Regrettably? For whom? Why not? Given the dazzlingly exclusive personal specification, I'm fairly sure they wouldn't have been tripping over suitable candidates. I'm a bit bitter and twisted about this, you're right. I'd much rather have been the chucker as opposed to the chucky. But life will go on. I have so many unanswered questions though. Is cuff training any good? Can it be if it doesn't fly in the face of a label that lacks scientific validity and reliability? Can it be if it doesn't challenge the shameful and damaging implementation of the ICD-11, a system that claims to be clinical but one that has been clearly set up to exclude and gatekeep vulnerable people from getting the support and services they require? Can it be if it isn't mandatory? What can possibly change if the main repeat perpetrators of prejudice and discrimination remain unsanctioned? Can it be if it doesn't equip those well-minded souls who do come to the training to strongly challenge that bad practice? As Bishop Desmond Tutu once said, if you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. If an elephant has its foot on the tail of a mouse and you say that you are neutral, the mouse will not appreciate your neutrality. Once the £11 million has been spent, what will become of the pathways to services for people lumbered with the personality disorder label? Will it just lead to a cliff edge, complete with a dark abyss for thousands to fall into? What of the people who don't make a noise or who don't have anyone to shout out on their behalf? I once put this to my social work managers. There are thousands of people, possibly those in the greatest need, who will never get anywhere near the support they require. My manager's response? Don't you think we're busy enough? If patient contact for the Advanced Lived Experience Cuff Development Lead Band 7 is merely incidental, then how can we possibly hope for real, meaningful change? What about the other organisations and silos involved in the delivery of mental health support or otherwise? The horribly flawed criminal justice system, including the judiciary, probation, psychiatry, prisons and the police. The Department of Work and Pensions, whose draconian and punitive systems have re-traumatised vulnerable people over and over again. Schools, colleges and universities that barely have the funding to provide education, never mind mental health support. Employers, the media, both mainstream and social. Maybe I need to expect that this was never for me. As a social worker, I had some naive notion that I could change the system from the inside, and that drove me fucking nuts. Would this just be more of the same? I've got to say, the whole process broke my heart a little. A thwarted belief that there might be a place for someone with my unique experience and talents really knocked the shit out of me. I'm really lucky. I'm incredibly well supported. Ella's hugged the hell out of my pain, and I've got a whole horde of friends tilting their heads as they smile wryly. What the fuck were you thinking, Chris? And what about all your other stuff? At the beginning of all this, I told you I had my heart broken twice. I'll do my best to be brief here, but you might want to grab yourself a quick cup of tea before I continue. Ah, you're back. Any chance of a hug? That's better. Thanks. Anyway, after having been punched in the face by the system, I returned to my ancestral home, Twitter, in search of solace. I soon stumbled across a thread by some fellow activisty types where they were talking about LXPs, or lived experience practitioners, to the uninitiated. Before long, I learned in this small but significant sphere in my Twitterverse that my kind of experience wasn't welcome there either. I was told that, arguably, my experience of social workering should be seen as an exclusion criteria for lived experience jobs, since the employment of me and others like me would simply perpetuate the unequal power dynamic and institutional prejudice inherent in the systems. Folk implied that by saying I had both professional and lived experience of mental ill health, I was somehow suggesting I was better than other folk. It certainly gives me alternative perspectives on the situation. It doesn't make me a loony plus. I was told that employing people like me, people of the same class, social status and perceived credibility as the perpetrators of prejudice and discrimination in this oppressive system would serve to perpetuate those flawed services. I started out this little journey thinking I had a foot in both camps, only to find, to some at least, I have a foot in neither. Suddenly, my experiences of childhood bereavement, poverty, neglect, and sexual abuse, experiences that drove me to become a social worker because I wanted to be there for folk when nobody had been there for me, were seen as somehow invalid. I wanted to be a fucking author. I didn't want any of this shit. I went into social work with all the best intentions, not a desire to oppress and control, but to support folk in the driving seats of their lives as much as I was able. I did it for 20 years before it nearly fucking killed me. I was an individual in a system. I wasn't the system. I come from a working class background. I lived in a council house. My dad was a steelworker and my mum worked in the Golden Wonder crisp factory. I've had a lifetime of craziness and the damage caused by being ostracised by employers, friends and family. By the medications and lack of services, I've experienced the trauma of drug withdrawal time and again. I've got fucking type 2 diabetes, probably caused by taking huge amounts of antipsychotics. There are days when I can hardly walk because of the probable peripheral neuropathy caused by this bastard condition. I've got constant tinnitus and pins and needles in my hands and feet, all because of the life experiences that led to my lived experience. I've been homeless, incarcerated. I've lost fucking everything. My home, my car, my children, my cats. Everything that I knew and held dear. And yet, there are those who still have the fucking audacity to claim I'm in some way privileged. The same people who claim my lived experience is somehow sullied, occluded by my desire to help others by my ultimately misguided choice of profession. Don't you see you're creating a false dichotomy? Like thousands of others, I've been damaged by the system from within and without, as both a punter and a professional. If you negate my lived experience purely based on my career choices, based on that lived experience, then it's time to take a long, hard look at your own prejudices. By excluding me and others like me, you're being every bit as prejudicial as the systems you want to change. We are victims of those systems, and I know we are far better together than apart. We need to work together to bring about change. We need to highlight this astonishingly poor practice and the flaws in all the systems. We need to bring this to the attention of the wider public by all means possible. Social and mainstream media, books, films, art, poetry, interpretive dance and smoke signals. I appreciate the crazy community. Our community is not a homogenous group. But there are millions of us. If we can somehow point in a similar direction, if not the same direction, we'd be unstoppable. I truly believe that. Together, we can change the systems that see value in squeezing our square peg experiences into their round hole corporate worlds. But we need to work together. But these two experiences of exclusion and rejection took me to some very dark places. Places that I've only been to a number of times when I lost everything, both as a child and as an adult. Times when I nearly lost myself. I can't sustain that level of pain. So I'm telling you, here and now, you will never hurt me like that again. Walk a mile.